everyone. Thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's March 2020, and you're listening to episode 165, which is a discussion with Jay Richards about socialism. On this episode, I'm joined by Dr. J.W. Richards, who is an assistant research professor in the Bush School of Business at the Catholic University of America. He is also the author of the recently released book, Eat, Fast, Feast, Heal Your Body While Feeding Your Soul, A Christian Guide to Fasting. Jay has written a feature article for the Christian Research Journal, and it's called History's Bloody Mess, Why Marxism and Socialism Always Fails, and you can read it for free online at our website, equip.org. Jay, it's good to have you on.
Thanks so much. Good to be with you, Melanie.
Well, right now in the United States, it is a presidential election year, and I just want to preface all of this by saying, in bringing up some of these subject matters, we're not trying to be political, because the Christian Research Institute and the journal in specific, we deal with Christian apologetics, Christian ethics, cultural apologetics, and so forth. And so I just want our listeners to know to just hang with us through this discussion, because we really want to think about what is a biblical worldview on civil government. So, you know, Christian ethics helps us apply a biblical worldview on all kinds of issues, including, as I just mentioned, civil government. And I think all Christians would agree that government cannot save people or ever fundamentally change the human heart. So I want to ask you, why does it matter that Christians need to have a biblical worldview about civil government?
Well, it's because this is God's world. I mean, certainly God came to save us from our sin, but he didn't just come in to just sort of snatch our souls up to heaven. God is redeeming the entire world, and civil society and government is a part of human reality. And while it's certainly true that we don't rely on the federal government to bring people to Christ, for instance, it does shape what we can do, whether we can exercise our faith. And, you know, it's often said that politics is downstream from culture, which is true, but culture is also downstream from politics. If you have a law that mandates abortion in all 50 states, that's going to have moral and cultural consequences. And it's the same thing with economic policy. If we care about our fellow human beings, we want to help people rather than hurt them, and we should as Christians, then we got to know something about politics and something about economics, whatever our political affiliations may be.
Well, as I mentioned at the start of this podcast, it is a presidential election year in the United States. And so right now in the media, we're hearing this term socialism, which is part of our discussion today. And it's being used quite a bit in the public square. And so, you know, some social scientists will say that the word socialism can mean different things to different groups. And as a matter of fact, I was listening to NPR recently, and they were asking a social scientist about it and what in specific, currently, I don't know what will happen, where it's March 2020, there is a candidate, Bernie Sanders, he's still running right now. And he talks about democratic socialism. And this social scientist was saying that he's referring to, or she thinks he's referring to, FDR's vision and his New Deal programs in the United States. If people will recall, that was in the 1930s for recovery from the economic catastrophe of the Great Depression. And that's different than maybe some people thinking of socialism as a very scary thing, like the way it was practiced in the Soviet Union in the 20th century, or maybe today the government in Venezuela, or even in North Korea. So I want to ask you, is this only a semantical difference when we say the word socialism?
No, it's not. In fact, I would say it's an example of equivocation. People always want to use words that are appealing and that conjure up mental images that are pleasing. So that's why nobody talks about, you know, I want to implement the Soviet gulags, right? Socialism has always had kind of positive connotations because it has the word social in it. We are social beings. And so certainly anybody can mean anything by any particular word. The question is, what does it actually mean? And the first thing you should do is just look in the dictionary, look at Merriam-Webster, which is, you know, it tells us how the word is traditionally used. And it's defined as a political and economic system in which the state, that is the government, owns the means of production. In other words, owns all of the productive property in a society. The second definition is a society in which private property is abolished. That's just what the word means. Now, whether Bernie Sanders means that or not, I think it's a complicated question. I don't think he just means FDR's social welfare programs, because if he did, there wouldn't be anything for him to do, because we have all those programs. We have Medicare, we have Social Security and many of those things. Bernie Sanders, in contrast, he actually calls for the nationalization of the banks. He calls for the nationalization of the energy sector. So at least to that degree, he is socialist. If a political candidate or a person wants to nationalize, that is, take something that's in the private sector and put it under the control of the government, then that person is to that degree socialist. Now, there is a difference between the kind of Marxist Soviet style socialism that we had in the Soviet Union or that you have in the People's Republic of China, and that those were implemented initially by violent revolution, which is in accord with Marxist theory. Other socialists, like I think Bernie Sanders and say the British Labour Party after World War II, they want to bring in socialism, real socialism. They want to do it at the ballot box. In other words, they want to do it by majority vote. And so that is a relevant distinction that, you know, there's different ways to bring about socialism. But I think it's really important that we first nail down the definition and make sure everybody's using the word in the same way.
Well, originally you wrote our article because back in 2018, maybe about 18 months ago, it was Karl Marx's 200th birthday, and it was actually celebrated with great fanfare in the United States and in the West, I would say. And I was reading the New York Times in an op-ed where they were just going on about how great Karl Marx was, and we have misunderstood some of the things that he had stood for. So, you know, given the current political climate, I would say, or the cultural climate, why has his views, Karl Marx's views, enjoyed such a popular renaissance right now in America?
Well, I would say in a sense, they never did go away. They disappeared from the public consciousness after the collapse of the Soviet Union. And everybody was sort of talking about the benefits of markets for about 10 or 15 years. Then we had the tech bubble in 1999 and then the financial crisis in 2008. And what happened, if you look at the details, is that the academic defenders of Marxist theory, who were well ensconced in, you know, cultural institutions and in academic institutions, they just came back out of the woodwork, and they've had an opportunity now to educate 20 some odd years of students who have no memory of the Soviet Union or the Cold War. And so I think what we're seeing is the sort of the fruits of their efforts behind the scenes for a while and then up front in the last few years. And so that's why we're seeing a surge of interest in socialism among the young, that is, those who've gone through college more recently and those who have no memory of the Cold War and the Soviet Union. I think that's what's happening. The academic and cultural advocates of socialism and Marxism, they went behind the scenes for a while, educated young people, and now the brand has sort of gotten renewed. And so they're back out in the open again.
So speaking of the young, you're talking about people who don't have any memory of some of these historical things that happened. Could you kind of let our listeners know what was the key argument of Karl Marx's worldview? I mean, what's so bad about it?
Yeah, I mean, the worst thing about it is that it's materialistic. Karl Marx held a view called dialectical materialism, which is basically said that history works its way through a series of stages by the dialectical interplay, that is the conflict between different social classes, so that your class and even your consciousness is ultimately determined by your material and economic circumstance. So if you're a member of the working class and work in a factory, that entirely determines what you think. And if you're a factory owner, what Marx called the bourgeoisie, then that's going to entirely determine how you think. And so we're ultimately just these machines that are working out these blind materialist historical processes. And he thinks that Marx thinks he discovered the kind of scientific historical pattern by which these stages will work themselves out. And so sort of philosophically, and your listeners are philosophically astute, many might already notice that the theory isn't even consistent with the theorist. In other words, if we are thinking is entirely determined by these material preconditions or by our social class, then how did Karl Marx himself transcend his social class? He himself was middle class. And so very often, if you look at a materialist theory, you'll notice that the theory itself isn't even consistent with the existence of the theorist. That's the kind of key philosophical problem. There's also a fundamental economic problem that maybe we can talk about a little later, which is really, it's kind of the reason I think that for many people, economically, his argument was plausible is because he embedded this key economic assumption into his argument, which we know to be false.
Well, one of the things that you go over in your article is that you talk about the communist revolution in Russia. So why don't you just tell us what really happened during that time? Like you mentioned earlier, there's some of us that are younger that might not remember that, and you know why that was significant.
Well, it was significant because it was really the first full-scale effort at a national level to implement Marxist theory. So Marx and his co-worker Friedrich Engels wrote this book, The Communist Manifesto, in 1848. There were some abortive attempts at revolution in Germany and other places in Europe for a few decades. It was finally in about 1917 during the Russian Revolution. So we had World War I was going on, and a party called the Bolsheviks essentially during this Russian Revolution came to power, and they tried to implement under Vladimir Lenin what they saw as the basic precepts of Marxism. And so according to Marxist theory, you have this stage called capitalism that Marx called the kind of industrial economy of the 19th century, in which people become more productive and they move into cities and you have factories. And then that eventually collapses and it gives rise to a stage called socialism, where the people confiscate the means of production. In other words, they kill all the owners and then the state owns everything on behalf of the people. And then you have this socialist stage, which for Marxist theory is temporary. And so that was what you had first in Russia and then the surrounding countries, which then later became a part of the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, the USSR, which were quite self-consciously Marxist and socialist. And the idea was that we're going to implement socialism and this will last for a few decades. And then eventually a new so-called socialist man will emerge, a new human nature. And then the state will wither away, socialism will wither away, and you'll get this communist utopia where you need no government, there's no want, everyone sort of is able to do whatever he or she wants to do. That's the communist utopia that they're looking forward to. But and so it had to come through socialism. Okay, that's a nice theory, but if you actually look at the details, by 1919, Lenin realized socialism was a disaster. Millions of peasants were dying because they had nationalized all the farms and basically said the peasants are going to work and then we're going to just pay them a fixed amount and their work is not going to, and salary aren't going to be connected in any way. Millions of people started starving. And so Lenin himself had to implement prices and market reforms. And so the Soviet Union languished for decades trying to make this work. It was an utter catastrophe. Tens of millions of people died. And in the meantime, that was just the Soviet Union. So maybe conservative estimates are that 20 million people died in the Soviet Union, not as a result of World War I or World War II, but as a result of at the hands of their own government. The Communist Revolution in China, which started in 1948, probably 65 million people died as a result of this experiment. And then you just kind of go down the list of countries, Cambodia and Vietnam, the Eastern European countries, something like 100 million people died at the hands of communist governments during the 20th century as a result of this experiment. So my argument would be, look, whatever you might think about the theory, look at how it actually worked out in practice. There's never been a more deadly idea.
But what about the people who would say, you know, some of that was recognized, for example, in China, that the revolution that Mao brought about wasn't really what they thought it was. And so they have had this new way of doing basically capitalist kind of business, but then that's separate from how, you know, the government runs things in the Communist Party. So in other words, what about the people who say, but they're so prosperous? I mean, you know, look at cities like Beijing and Shanghai, and they're recruiting American professors to work there. And it's like living in New York City, and there's lower crime, and people are millionaires. I mean, what about that?
Yeah, absolutely. It's just that not one of those examples has anything to do with socialism. In every case, it's a result starting in about 1988 of liberalization in China, in which the leader at the time implemented essentially what you think of as enterprise zones. So as you mentioned, around Shanghai, around Guangzhou, which is north of Hong Kong. And if you go to those parts of China, it's a sort of economic free-for-all. It's more free market than probably anything in the United States. And those places have prospered. And so the degree to which The People's Republic of China has become less socialist. They have been prosperous. The places where they haven't is precisely the places that have continued to be poor. So if anything, that's another argument against socialism. It's just like the fact that Lenin, even in the early 1920s, had to implement market reforms in order for socialism to work at all. That's an argument against socialism rather than for it.
You're listening to the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest is J.W. Richards, who has written a feature article for the Christian Research Journal, and it's called History's Bloody Mess, Why Marxism and Socialism Always Fails. And you can read his article for free online at our website, equip.org. We'd like you to partner with us to help us continue to produce this podcast and all of our great content, including exclusive online articles, by being a partner in a couple of different ways. First of all, the best way you can partner with us is just tell a friend about this podcast. The more people that subscribe to the podcast and find out about it, the more people that can be aware of our resources to help equip them to defend their faith and to grow in their Christian faith. And then another way you can help us out is just becoming a subscriber to our print edition. You can do that at our website, equip.org, and a subscription is $33.50. And then if a subscription is not in your budget, we'd ask you to help us out in a small way, maybe with a smaller amount like $3 or $5 or $10 by giving that to us as a tip, which you can easily do at our website. You go to equip.org, you see magazine, you go to the drop-down menu, you see Postmodern Realities Podcast. When you click on that, you'll get to the main landing page. And if you click on any episode or this one, you will find a link where you can give us a tip. And so we thank you for your partnership. And another way you can help us is to give us a review. Rate us on Apple Podcasts. You can go to Apple Podcasts, look for Postmodern Realities. You can just quickly give us a star review. Or if you have a few minutes of your time, give us a written review. And as a matter of fact, if you've been thinking about giving us a written review and you haven't given us one yet, we'd like to ask you to give us one even this week. And thank you for listening.
I was just asking you about some of the economic reforms in China. And so I guess the question I want to ask is socialism different than communism? Because I think a lot of people, and maybe myself included, that didn't study economics in depth or anything, thinks about socialism as not as austere as communism. In other words, communism is a step even further from socialism.
Well, not exactly. I mean, people do often use it that way. The word, it's sort of like communism is socialism on steroids. But the problem is if you look at, say, the countries that we think of as communists, like the former Soviet Union, were called the Union not of communist Soviet republics, but of socialist Soviet republics. So they themselves understood themselves as socialists. The reason they were also communists is because they had a communist aspiration. So in other words, what communism is, that's the end point, the kind of utopia that Marxist experiments are hoping to get to. It's just that they never actually do that. And so very often we'll just kind of use communism to refer to these violent Marxist experiments. But there never actually has been a communist society because they always get stuck in socialism. Now, I do think there's a distinction between revolutionary socialism like you had in the Soviet Union or the People's Republic of China, and the kind of democratic socialism that you had, for instance, after World War II in the UK or in some of the Scandinavian countries in the early 1970s, where people adopted and voted for socialist candidates and implemented certain types of socialist policies. Those are obviously less deadly, and it's a lot easier to reverse those, which is what always happens when countries tend to do that, than you have under violent revolution. So I think the real distinction would just be between violent socialist revolution and nonviolent revolution. Communism is supposed to be the end point of the Marxist idea. It's just that we've never actually had a communist society in reality.
Well, you just mentioned Scandinavian countries, and I think a lot of people, at least right now at this point in 2020, will point to Scandinavian countries, specifically you mentioned Denmark, mm-hmm. as an example of great democratic socialism. And isn't that something that we should attain in the United States?
Well, it's a misnomer, though. So the Scandinavian countries all tried democratic socialism in the 1970s. And if you look at their economies, they tanked. And so the Sweden, for instance, I think in the 1970s at one point, the government owned about half of industry. So in other words, it had nationalized about half of all the jobs in the country. And it was an economic disaster. And so for a decade and a half or more, these countries have been reversing that. And so if you look at the Index of Economic Freedom today, in 2020, you'll notice all the Scandinavian countries are very high on the Index of Economic Freedom. Some of them, some years, even rank above the United States. So it's really a myth that these are still socialist countries in any to any large extent. And in fact, it's easier in some of these countries to start a business. Denmark, for instance, it doesn't even have a minimum wage laws. And so, yeah, they do have large sort of social welfare states. You could say that. That's absolutely true. But that comes from large taxes. It doesn't come from socialism. And so in Sweden, for instance, less than 15% of the economy now is actually owned by the government. So they've been moving in the other direction for a long time. So this idea that Scandinavia is a sort of socialist dream, it doesn't come from any actual knowledge of these countries. And in fact, the prime minister of Denmark a few years ago, actually, it was when Bernie Sanders was running for president in 2016, the president of Denmark, actually, he came out and said, look, this we don't have a socialist country. We have a market economy in Denmark. And so we sort of leave it at that. But people's sort of visions of what's actually happening in Scandinavia is quite different from the reality.
Well, and I think what is contrasted to the ideas of socialism and communism always is capitalism. So I want to ask you about that. What about that specific word capitalism and where did it come from? Because I think people tend to think that capitalism is not caring towards the community, towards the individual, especially people who are in marginalized communities where there isn't a lot of economic opportunity or education.
Yeah. And so what's funny is most people don't realize the word capitalism was actually popularized by Karl Marx himself. If you read, say, Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations, who's sort of the father of modern economics in 1776. He doesn't use or even know the word capitalism. And so it was actually a pejorative word from the very beginning. And unfortunately, we've kind of gotten stuck with it. For Marx, Marx thought the system was intrinsically exploitive. In other words, by definition, if you have an owner and you have people working for that owner in a factory, they're getting exploited. But the reality is, all you have to do is just look at the evidence. Look at those countries that have the most economic freedom and then compare how do, say, the lowest 20% of that population fare in countries that enjoy economic freedom compared to countries that don't. Now, I'm the first one to admit there's no economic system that's going to bring perfect utopia or give us all everything that we want to. So what we have to do is we have to compare the live alternatives. My argument would be based on the evidence. What we know is that systems that have private property, limited government, rule of law, and then a lot of economic freedom on top of that, people just tend to do better. People on average and actually lower income people are much more likely to do better than countries that are different. And so that's why, for instance, if you look at immigration patterns, people will risk their lives to get into countries that have a lot of economic freedom. People risk their lives to get out of countries that don't. I think that in some ways is the strongest testimony as you could possibly have about the actual benefits of market economies for the poor.
Well, you did write before that, you wrote another article for us about just a kind of a hermeneutics article that we had asking you about the book of Acts, because I think there are some Christians that would point to this idea of Christians living in community in the early church and, you know, wondering if that was some kind of example of communism or socialism because they were selling their property and donating it to the church and, well, except for Ananias and Sapphira, but besides them, you know, they were donating this and everybody was sharing with one another as there were needs that were arising. So isn't that what our government should be more like?
Well, I always get this question, Melanie, and the reason is because we, again, aren't sort of being careful about our definitions. So remember, if we're talking about socialism, under socialism, the government owns the means of production. It abolishes private property. But of course, the government's not even in the picture in the early chapters of Acts. The centurions are not, you know, breaking down doors and taking people's possessions. What's happening is sharing. And sharing is not socialism or communism. You know, I share with my children and my wife and I share our possessions. But we don't have a little socialist commune here. That's appropriate for family relationships. And in what was happening in the book of Acts, if folks remember is that the Jews had come from around the Roman world, many speaking different languages, descended upon Jerusalem during Pentecost, and then the Holy Spirit descended and thousands of them became Christians all at once. And so now you have all these brand new Christians, a few of whom are local in Jerusalem, the others of whom are away from their jobs and their families and their connections. And so under that temporary circumstance, the Holy Spirit moved upon those who were local and said, sell your stuff and share among the new believers here so that they could stay and build fellowship and build up the faith. There's no evidence that this was sort of prescribed as the way that every church community was supposed to organize itself. You read Paul's letters, for instance. He's not telling the Christians at Thessalonica or at Corinth that they should arrange things this way. For all we know, this is a 6-week or a 6-month temporary circumstance. And then presumably those new Christians, those Jewish Christians, went back to their homes at some point rather than staying in Jerusalem. And so the key distinction is the government wasn't involved. And this was an example of voluntary sharing among Christians, which is absolutely a good thing to do. And under certain circumstances, the type of sharing that they underwent, though somewhat extreme, would make perfect sense. But nobody should think that that gives any kind of justification for the state confiscating private property, which is a completely different thing.
But what about just using the government, in other words, to make everything much more equal, right? So we're in an election year, and some candidates are saying, by pursuing socialism, we can have college for all people, Medicare, medical insurance for everybody, jobs for everybody, and therefore we will then live in a just society. And as a Christian, I think some Christians find that very compelling. Why wouldn't we want to do that?
Yeah, I mean, would we want a world in which everybody had all the medical care they had, or when everybody, you know, made enough, or where, say, one parent could make enough to, you know, have the other parent stay home and have 8 kids? Of course, those are beautiful aspirations. But you need to have some kind of economic literacy when you're thinking about these things. So, for instance, a president just declaring everybody's going to get free health care doesn't make it free. Declaring that somebody has a right, say, to heart surgery, it doesn't magically bring up a bunch of extra hearts for heart transplant surgery. These are scarce goods. And so there's a question about how they're best allocated. If we're actually interested, sort of economically, if we're actually interested in increasing the amount of healthcare available, or the prices of healthcare, we need to make more healthcare available. We need to decrease the scarcity of that. The government sort of declaring this doesn't make that the case. In the same way, the government declaring college free doesn't make it free. I'm a college professor. Somebody's going to have to pay me, right? Somebody's going to have to pay for the buildings. They have to pay for the lights. Who's going to do that? So the question, somebody's going to have to pay for it. Bernie Sanders or any other politician can't make that free. The only thing he could do is create a situation where one person, the customer, in this case the student, has it free at the point of service by it being paid for by someone else. That's what's always happening. So whenever you hear a politician talking about giving you something for free, just say, okay, that makes no sense. It's not air, right? It's a scarce good. And so somebody's going to pay for it. So who should pay for it? Well, it's not clear to me how it's just that a student going to college that's getting the college education should have his degree paid for by some factory worker that didn't go to college, which is exactly what would be required. And incidentally, college education would be much worse than it actually is. And so this is why we need to, as Christians, if we're going to think about economic policy, we can't just have our sort of morality and our ethics straight. We actually have to understand some basic things about economics. Otherwise, we end up falling for these really just kind of magical claims that politicians have the power to just create healthcare or something out of thin air.
Well, wouldn't the argument be that it wouldn't be worse for everybody if everyone had free college? And if you go to state, I don't think Bernie is saying, or whoever politician, not just Bernie, I don't know much about his campaign, but just, I think politicians that would hold to that would say, obviously not private colleges, but, you know, public ones, maybe community college, that could be free for everyone that's paid through our taxes.
Well, that's not what they're saying. They're actually arguing for free. In fact, a college, the candidate that actually just dropped out, Elizabeth Warren, was calling for forgiveness of debts to all college debts wherever they went. But the problem is that community college is already almost free. So if you live in any state in the union, you graduate from high school and you're poor, you can get a Pell Grant and go to community college for free right now. In fact, you can go to sort of second tier state schools almost for free right now through a Pell Grant. So that already exists. So that's not, now we could sort of debate the sort of wisdom or the value of that, but that already exists. And so the only thing on offer at the moment is whether somebody is going to pay for an expensive college education that they didn't receive and that somebody else got. It's still, even today, only about half of Americans go to college, and a lot of kids that go to college and get huge debt, unfortunately, would actually have been better off going to trade school and developing a skilled trade. And so it's not as if a college education is a valuable good for absolutely everyone. I think a market is actually much, much better for both reducing the cost and increasing the availability of those things than any kind of government supposedly free plan would ever be able to accomplish.
And what about, how would you address the people who would say, well, but there is an increasing disparity in income, quote unquote, inequality in this country with so many billionaires, especially in the tech sector. And, you know, they can hire all these accountants to do, you know, evading of taxes. Shouldn't we be collecting the taxes that they already own, or should we up their taxes just so that the middle class or others don't have to be taxed as much, and it would just be more fair and we could all contribute more?
Well, we already have an extremely progressive income tax. And so this idea that the rich don't pay taxes is crazy. And in fact, the bottom half of all income earners already in the United States don't pay any income taxes at all because of deductions. The top one, the top 10% pay the vast majority of income taxes already. So that's a, you know, people have that sort of impression, but all they have to do is Google who pays the most income taxes, I think, to crack that impression. Now, there is increasing inequality because of some tech billionaires. And so Jeff Bezos, for instance, is fabulously wealthy, and Bill Gates. The kind of fallacy that's often involved, though, when people are thinking of this is the so-called zero-sum game fallacy. And the idea is that, well, that guy got rich by making someone else poorer, but that doesn't follow. I mean, we know perfectly well, for instance, that the late Steve Jobs, the Apple Corporation, he didn't get rich by stealing iPhones from homeless people. It's not like the wealth was already out there. In a law-abiding country in which people's gains are not ill-gotten, say from theft, their wealth is primarily a function of the fact that they figured out a way to provide things for people. And so maybe people don't like Jeff Bezos, but he's an incredible businessman that's created a business model in which a lot of people participate in. And so the question is, okay, so what exactly is just about essentially saying, okay, that person has more than somebody else. He earned it, but we should still take it from him. I mean, at some point, if you're using the tax system for theft, you're actually engaging in an injustice. What we want, and I think what we should focus on, is not the kind of the gap between, say, me and Steve Jobs or me and Jeff Bezos. The gap is massive. It's not a morally problematic gap. The problem would be, say, the gap between me and my income and someone who is barely scraping by, right? But the problem there is not the gap between our incomes. The problem is that somebody else is barely scraping by. And so the real moral question, I think, should always be, okay, do we have a system in which people who are poor can, through their own effort, actually work themselves out of poverty or not? So in other words, the problem is not a gap between incomes or some guy being richer than someone else. The problem is actual poverty. And for that, you have to focus on what's called the mobility of incomes. Are people able to actually move in and out of different income tax brackets? And people do that. If you actually look at what happens for most people over time, I don't think it happens enough. So what's the kind of best solution for that? Well, the best solution for that is an economy that's creating lots of jobs.
Well, I would like to know, why does it seem like socialism never seems to die? In other words, it seems like it's gone through these various cycles, but here again it is, and it's being glamorized at the moment. And also, just as we've talked through all of these things, I think there's some Christians wondering, well, there are other Christians out there that are evangelicals who would call themselves socialists, maybe even evangelical theologians. And so Why wouldn't we hold to socialism?
Well, I would say that the first part of the question is, okay, why is this reemerging? And I do think it's because socialism has always had a good branding that, say, Nazism, which, by the way, stands for National Socialism, is not. Nobody ever says, well, National Nazism hasn't really ever been tried. You know, like socialism always sort of gets that that sort of favor. I think it's because socialism appeals to people's moral intuitions about equality. And so if you think a just society requires equality of outcome, so not just equal treatment before the law, but this idea that everybody should have basically the same amount of stuff, if that sort of appeals to you and you think socialism will give you that, then I think people can be led astray. Now, my argument would be, look, that's not what socialism has ever done. Wherever it's tried, what you get is a very, very small wealthy elite and then widespread poverty. And so in the claim of equality, you actually get the kind of grotesque inequalities that you actually get under socialism. I do think it's a kind of moral intuition about equality, though, that's involved. And I think for a lot of Christians that think of themselves as socialists, look, that would have described me when I was a freshman in college. I was reading the Communist Manifesto and thought Christians should be socialists, but it was a really superficial way of thinking. Basically, Jesus cares about the poor. He expects us to care about the poor. I think socialism cares about the poor, therefore we should all be socialist. I mean, it sort of appeals as this kind of mental construct in your mind, but the more you learn about economics, about what actually helps people as opposed to what sort of feels good, the less appealing I think that picture is. And so that's why I always try to bring people back to, rather than these kind of mental castles that they construct in their heads, these mental pictures, these imaginings of a socialist utopia, what actually works and what doesn't? Where have people actually emerged from poverty? What are the social conditions by which cultures are able to emerge from absolute poverty? Not into perfection or the kingdom of God, but from absolute poverty. And we actually know that. It's not like at this point in 2020, it's a mystery about what conditions socially allow people to emerge from poverty. And it's this kind of boring oatmeal stuff. Rule of law, limited government, detailed and precise property rights, stable money, economic freedom. Those aren't the kind of sexy things that maybe appeal to young people that like the ideas of revolution. Those are the things that have actually allowed billions of people in the 20th century to emerge from poverty. And so if we're interested in actually helping the poor rather than just kind of feeling good about them, I say let's focus on the things that we know that actually help them rather than these imaginative constructs that we're attracted to.
And I will mention this because I don't know if all of our listeners realize that when we talk about, well, let's just tax, you know, the tech billionaires more. For example, Bill Gates does have his Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and it has more than $46 billion in assets, and they're trying to give it all away. So it's not that he isn't doing things to help the marginalized, because that's one of the things that they want to do, to help out in areas where there is, you know, extreme poverty. So
that's right.
It's not like they're not giving back. I mean, it's possible. I'm not saying all of tech entrepreneurs are as generous as what Bill Gates is doing right now, but I just did want to point out to people that has this giant foundation that is giving away money.
But I actually think, and this is a contrarian point, if you actually look at the amount of wealth that Bill Gates created as the founder of Microsoft, it dwarfs what he's doing with his, even if you assume all his charitable giving is good, and it's not, some of his stuff is not great, but let's assume it's all good and benevolent. Bill Gates himself actually created several $1 trillion worth of economic value as a businessman. So he's not giving back as a philanthropist, he's giving in a different way. But very often, the most value-creating thing that an entrepreneur can do is precisely to be a business person, because in the world that God has created, this fallen world, the primary way in which economic wealth is created is, it's not from charity. It's not from thinking nice thoughts. It's actually from enterprise and business and trade and innovation. And what's funny, though, is that entrepreneurs often discover, this is a kind of a fact about human psychology, is that the more wealthy they get, the less satisfaction they get from their wealth. And well-formed ones very quickly realize, you know, I'm not getting satisfaction from acquiring more wealth. And so they set up foundations and they become philanthropists, which is a very common pattern. But I wouldn't want people to think that, well, as a businessman, a person, you know, Bill Gates took wealth from the economy and now he's giving back. No, he was creating wealth in the first place. He captured some of that wealth as his personal wealth, and now he's giving that away.
And just to come full circle, so why should we care about economics and civil government? It just seems that, you know, how does this really impact the Christian apologists? So through this discussion, how can the Christian apologists engage with other people?
Well, I think the first thing that you got to do when you're talking about these things is to try to demonstrate that you actually care about people. So you're less interested in winning the argument than you are at sort of getting to the bottom of what causes poverty, what causes despair. These are real human problems that I think God expects us to care about. But God told us to love him, not just with our hearts, but with our minds. And so part of loving God with your mind is to say, okay, what is it, if we're worried about somebody's economic poverty, what are the things that cause people to be poor? And what are the things that allow them to lift themselves up or to, you know, with help to be able to get out of poverty? The good news is that we know this stuff now. 200 years ago, we didn't really know the details about what works economically. Now it's something that we can learn. And I would say if Christians are going to have a voice in these debates and are going to have an informed voice that actually helps people, then we owe it to ourselves to just learn a little bit about these things so that our opinions will be well-formed rather than just going off half-cocked.
And so finally, I want to end with some fun rapid-fire questions for Jay. So Jay, hot coffee, hot chocolate, or hot tea?
Is it black or with cream in it? I would say
However you like it.
Tea. If I have to do it black, I would say tea. If I get to put some milky stuff in it, then it would be coffee.
And are you an introvert or extrovert?
I'm mostly an extrovert, but my wife accuses me of becoming more of an introvert over time.
And are you highly organized or go with the flow?
I am mostly go with the flow, but I hate it. And so I constantly set up countermeasures to try to keep myself organized, but I'm not organized by nature, unfortunately.
And would you rather do your own taxes or be seated on a jury?
I would rather be seated on a jury for sure.
And finally, you've just written a new book on fasting. Give listeners your 30-second elevator pitch about why Christians should fast.
Christians should fast because I think it's the way that God designed our bodies. And if you look at the way Christians practiced eating, we always had periods of fasting and days of fasting followed by feasts. We have kept the feasts and mostly dropped the fast. And I think both spiritually and physically, we're better off as individuals and we're better off as the body of Christ if we reintroduce fasting into our spiritual disciplines.
Well, thanks, Jay, for being a guest on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Great to be with you.
You've been listening to the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest has been Dr. J.W. Richards, who has written a feature article for the journal, and it's called History's Bloody Mess, Why Marxism and Socialism Always Fails. And you can read his article for free online at our website, equip.org.
We'd like to hear from you, so connect with us on social media, like the Bible Answer Man Facebook page, and follow CRI, Christian Research Journal, Hank Anagraph, and the Bible Answer Man on Twitter. And please subscribe to the Bible Answer Man channel on YouTube. If you like this episode, please subscribe to the Postmodern Realities podcast on iTunes, and please rate and review our podcast. When you rate and review our podcast, it helps others see our content. And please share this episode on your social media accounts. Be sure you tune in daily to the Bible Answer Man broadcast hosted by CRI President Hank Anagraph, who answers your questions live on air. To ask Hank a question, call 888-ASK-HANK Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. In addition, head to iTunes and subscribe to Hank Unplugged, Hank's audio podcast. Follow Hank off the grid, where he has in-depth conversations with some of the brightest minds discussing topics you care about. So until our next Christian Research Journal author conversation, thanks for listening to the Postmodern Realities podcast.